When it comes to making it as a performer on stage or on screen, it's usually as an actor, singer, or dancer. Most people like myself are good at one or two of them. We tend to gravitate toward the ones we're most comfortable with and can truly express our artistry. Well, today's guest started out in dancing and is actually quite an amazing contemporary dancer with a very unique name.
My full name is Barton Randall Cowperthwaite, and my mom wanted me to change my name to Barton Randall, but I think Cowperthwaite is so unique, and Barton is so unique too. It's my mother's maiden name, and so there was definitely talk. I even think my mom bought like the BartonRandall.com domain just in case, but it never felt like the move, and now every podcast or interview I do, I always applaud someone who can pronounce the last name correctly. It's very exciting.
Well, I've been practicing. So, Barton Cowperthwaite is a dancer first and foremost, with performances ranging from the opera La Traviata to Travis Wall's Shaping Sound Dance Company. The esteemed choreographer Lara Lubavitch described him as a movement poet, and credits him with having what he calls musical visualization. Quote, rather than hearing the music, this kind of dancer has the impression of being the music, end quote. But Barton has also been singing the music as well in a couple of productions at City Center's Encores and in the national tour of American in Paris. He's also been exercising his acting chops in a few movies and, of course, in his breakout role of Oren in the Netflix series, Tiny Pretty Things. Through all of it, Barton has proved he's much more than just a good mover and a pretty face. In our conversation, he shares both the joys and disappointments of working on that hit TV series that ended up being canceled. He opens up about realizing his own weaknesses as a performer and needing to constantly work at improving his abilities. And he also talks about the time he went on for the lead role in American in Paris with just 15 minutes notice.
I never thought I would sing in front of people. Like, I grew up being told that I had a terrible voice and I was ruining a song if I was singing along with it. So to be in LA singing in front of 3,000 people on a Saturday night was, you know, terrifying.
Welcome and thank you for joining me for another episode of Why I'll Never Make It, an award-winning Top 25 Theater podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, an actor and singer, talking with fellow creatives each episode of personal struggles and professional hardships with lessons we can all learn from. The website is whyillnevermakeit.com, where you can subscribe to bonus episodes and offer your own financial support to the production of this podcast. Again, that's whyillnevermakeit.com. Welcome, Barton. It is so good to have you in my home studio. Wonderful, wonderful to see you.
I'm so glad to be here.
We have such a good time together, and I'm so glad that we got to meet last August. It's only been, like 9 months ago, 9, 10 months ago.
Not that long. The flame burned hot and fast.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. But we got to work together for a new show, Imposters. You know, it's in the process of being shopped around now, so we'll see what happens. But that was kind of a whirlwind experience for you, just getting sucked into that because it just came out of nowhere, right?
Yeah, I was on the train with my girlfriend going to see her family, and my agent called and was like, hey, there's a project. They need you in Syracuse in less than 48 hours, and you have a paragraph in Mandarin. It's like, cool, let's do it.
Now, you would obviously audition for it, so at least you
knew. I didn't even audition. So one of my agent's clients had the role originally and is friends with Sandy and Elizabeth, and he ended up booking a role in season 3 of Barry. So he went to L.A. to shoot that and had to back out of Imposters. And so they were like, Barton's a pretty good match. Why don't we just give him the offer?
Oh, my gosh.
that's kind of cool to not have to audition, and that's only happened once in my life. But at the same time, you're like, I wasn't expecting this.
Oh, no, completely. Honestly, and that seems to be kind of a theme in my life where it's like, you know, very little notice, like come in. There was, you know, travel, travesties, trying to get to Syracuse. I was on a flight. We sat on the tarmac for 2 hours. It got canceled. They kept my bags. I got on a train. It was just like absolute pandemonium getting to Syracuse, but made it happen. And it was just such a whirlwind because it's like from finding out about the job to actually completing the job was like 4 days.
I do remember, like, as we were in that second day of shooting, you know, because we were going off like just a few hours of sleep. And, you know, the first few times you go through it is fine. But then like the seventh, eighth, ninth mm-hmm. take of a scene, because they're getting a different angle, I was like, wait, what is that speech? Like, it would just leave.
Yeah, and the brain just turns to total mush, and it's 2 a.m., and it's the last shot of the whole show.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I am so glad to have you here, because you've brought three great stories for us to talk about. And the first of which is something that I know a little something about, and that is being on a national tour. Mm-hmm. And you got to be with An American in Paris, which I got to see the show on Broadway, and it's a tiring show, right?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, it's a 3-hour show with a 20-minute ballet as the finale. So
right. Don't you love when they put that stuff at the end?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, let's do a large ballet at 10:30 p.m.
Now, you were in the ensemble of the national tour, and you were also the understudy for the lead role. And one night, ironically, on April Fool's Day, you had to go on for that lead role with only about 15 minutes notice. Now, that must have been quite a shock.
Literally, yeah. The alternate had called out, and then the lead decided about 15 minutes before curtain that an injury was flaring up and he wasn't going to be able to perform. And so it's April Fool's Day, and, you know, people are like knocking on doors and like Barton's going on, and everybody's like, April Fool's, ha ha. And then they see like wardrobe sprinting by with all of my costumes, and everybody is like, oh man, this is a go. So I hadn't rehearsed it in a month. I had not ever done it in costume with lights. I had never actually worked with Sarah Esty, who I ended up going on with.
Right, which happens sometimes when you're the understudy, because the understudy rehearsals will just be with all the understudies.
Exactly.
And then you hopefully get a put in, which is then with the actual cast, mm-hmm. the principals. And then when you go on, you've at least worked with them. But sometimes you don't get that.
Yeah, and so it was April 1st. It was also Saturday night, sold out at the Pantages in L.A.
Brilliant.
The Gershwin Estate was in the audience. So it was all just kind of like this perfect storm. And I love being under pressure. I just kind of like it. It just lights something up in me, and I just kind of come to life, and I'm just like, it's sink or swim. So feels like almost out of body. Like, it's just like, I'm gonna just trust. And if it goes, it goes. And if it doesn't, like, I'll go down swinging, at least. Like, I'd rather be embarrassed, I guess, than, like, clamp up and not get out there.
So during that show, during that performance, did you start to feel at home in the role? Or was it just kind of, like, nervous energy the whole time?
Yeah, it just was, like, electricity the whole time. I mean, there was, like, one line that I got a little dropped in act two, and Sarah picked it up for me right away, and like we were just back on track. So it really just felt like a roller coaster. Like, it was like the 15 minutes where I was like running the dance with Sarah in costume for the first time ever, like before the show goes, felt like the you're going up the roller coaster. And then, you know, when the curtain's up, it's just, you're just arms in the air screaming the whole way down.
Oh my gosh. But at the same time, this was your very first time to go on as well, right?
Yeah, it was my first time doing the whole thing, like A to Z. And it went really well. Like, the producer and I met like a week later, and he was like, I've really never heard of something like this going so well. I was really impressed. And, you know, I got a call from the Gershwins, and they gave you a good review. And so congratulations.
Well, the Gershwins approved, so that's good.
I was really pretty, I was, you know, beside myself. I was like, I got to do it. I had been through a lot on that tour too, lots of family stuff, had lost some people. So it just felt like this kind of karmic, like, justice, like, coming to fruition, like, this thing I had dreamed of for months and months and months, like, coming true, and I actually got to, like, do the thing. But, you know, as an artist, we, like, want to refine,
always
go back
tweaking
in there. Yeah, like, it was amazing to get to do it once, but, like, really, I wanted to do it over and over and over and over and over until it was, like, perfect.
Because you had been in rehearsals. They were the understudy rehearsals. So when the time came, obviously it was sudden, but did you feel ready?
So, like, when the call was actually made, I remember one of the dance captains coming into the dressing room and being like, okay, do you want to be in your dressing room or do you want to move to the principal dressing room? And I was like, I want to move to the principal dressing room. And she was like, okay, like, grab your things. And I grabbed, like a stress ball and, like, a teddy bear and, like, a book. Like, just everything I didn't need. I was like, okay, I'll just bring this stuff.
Because when are you going to be in your dressing room
during
the show?
Totally glazed over, yeah. Like, my brain just was, like, kind of mush for a second, and then it was just kind of like, okay, you've rehearsed this. I hadn't rehearsed it in literally a month because the guy who was on as our lead for the first 6 months of the tour was leaving, and so they were rehearsing his replacement. So my rehearsal priority got kind of bumped down as the understudy so they could train the replacement. And so I really hadn't, like, touched the role in a month.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I remember when I was at Disney World, there's the main show you're at, but then you can sub other shows and you learn them. And if they need, you know, if someone calls out, you know, like what happened with you, then you go in, and there was a particular show that I hadn't touched in a year. Like, I'd just been going and I just hadn't been there. And then they called me and said, can you come in? We're desperate. We need someone. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
And basically I told the cast when they got there, it's like, I haven't touched this show in a year. Now, fortunately, I had done the show several times, so I knew the role, but still, I just told everyone, I haven't done this in a year, so please go with me. And there was one moment which spotlight's on me, I kneel down, they're all, like, behind me, I have to start singing, and I went, what's the first line? And all of them just shouted the first line. I went, right. And then we just got it. That was, like, the only time. So that happens sometimes.
Classic. That's amazing. Yeah, it does. I mean, there's in American in Paris, like, the opening moment is, like, the French flag comes down and, like, flies over, and there's this moment where, like, the planes fly by, and Jerry kind of turns around and watches the planes fly over, and he's facing upstage, and then he turns to face the audience, and I almost came out from under the flag facing the audience, and so, like, that was my first kind of, like, faux pas, and I was like, okay, got it out of the way, and then, like, I felt like, okay, I got a mistake out, a little bit of jitters, and we can just, you know, hit the steps, hit the
marks.
Yeah,
because especially whenever you're thrown into something or maybe you don't feel as prepared or ready, then you're constantly kind of recognizing the fact that, okay, I'm doing these lines. Okay, what's the next line? Wait, where's my neck? Where do I block? I have this prop. I need to get the, you know, you're constantly going through the kind of the checklist of what you need to do in that scene. Were you ever able to get out of that and actually be the character and feel at home in it?
I definitely felt like I had moments where I was, like, having so much fun. You know, it was just a dream come true. Like, I was actually doing the thing that I had worked so hard on and, like, rehearsed for months and months and months on end to do. I never thought I would sing in front of people. Like, I grew up being told that I had a terrible voice and I was ruining a song if I was singing along with it. So to be in LA singing in front of 3,000 people on a Saturday night was, you know, terrifying, but I was just kind of like, it was something I'd wanted. And so I definitely felt like I had moments where I was able to be the character. And I think that's something that's amazing about rehearsal and repetition. Like, the body is just so much smarter than the brain. If you work on something and work on something and work on something, like, your body just learns it. And that knowledge, I think, like, you could talk about, like, trauma and how that lives in the body, but, like, it's the same for, like, steps and stuff when you're in a show. It just kind of, like, it lives in your body for a really long time, like, a lot longer than stuff will, like, stay consciously remembered in your brain.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a matter of us recognizing the fact that we have to get out of our own way. Because I've had those times where I missed a line and then I try to think of the line and then it's not coming. But as soon as I just like breathe and then just kind of open my mouth, then it starts flowing and I'm back in the rhythm of it again. And it can be when we start to tense up that it can just go off in another direction.
So many moments felt like out of body experiences where it was like where Barton was just kind of floating above and like watching me do the show from like a bird's eye view. It didn't even feel real until probably I was like off the tour, which was only 2 weeks later.
Right. Because you had actually put in your notice just a few weeks before you going in for the lead. And part of the reason for you giving your notice was that you weren't going on, that you weren't able to, you know, actually go on for the role you were understudying. So what led you to finally come to a determination that as much as I'm loving the tour, I need to leave because it's not servicing me as an artist?
Yeah, I mean, my goal was to do the lead. I had an amazing time on the tour and the cast was so incredible. The creative team was so incredible. But my goal was really to like do the lead. I knew that's where I would face the most challenges and the stuff that scared me the most was in that part. So I tried to negotiate for like a guaranteed performance. And as the understudy, that's just like not on the table. So after 6 months, they were like, you can renew if you want. And I was like, I don't think I'm going to, you know, there was stuff in my personal life, obviously. But then like, then there was this element of like, they're not giving me the performances that I want. And after I went on as the lead, I tried to leverage that and just be like, hey, look,
I did it.
And like with no rehearsal and no notice. And they were like, yeah, great job.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you for your service. Yeah.
Then having gone on for the lead role, then did it make you rethink like, well, maybe I could just tough this out and do it for longer?
No, because I had tasted it and knowing that I wasn't given the like trust or responsibility of getting to do it again. Like, yes, I was the understudy and like, yes, there is that kind of like, that's what you sign up for is the kind of unknown of like one day you'll get thrown on. But I just wanted them to throw me a bone. Like I was just like, give me a show and I'll stay for another 3-6 months. Like just one show. And they were like, we can't do that. So if that's not on the table, then I need to know that there's an opportunity for me to like be growing and to be facing fears. And at that point I was like, well, I've done it. I might as well go face the unknown.
For your second story, which you've been hinting at, and so now we're finally going to talk about the big thing that happened in December of 2020. Tiny Pretty Things had been postponed and it finally came out. And were you ready for the type of reaction that fans were going to give it? What happened that first month when it was out?
Oh, man, it was building. We were supposed to come out in August of 2020 and, you know, pandemic pushed us to October, and then it was like controversy with another show, and so they pushed us to December, and so it was just kind of like, just felt like a lot of stop and go, and then it finally came out, and we quickly were number one in the world. We were number one in the world for 2 weeks, and so that was just kind of like, it was shocking. I really believed in the show. Like, I knew what it was. I don't think I had kind of an augmented view of its like artistic prowess, but I was proud of it and I felt like it was unique and special. And of course it has its issues, but it's also just like a totally watchable show. And so I just was feeling so many things, you know, you're feeling like so excited, you're feeling so apprehensive about what it's going to achieve, how many people are going to be able to see it, how like, you're watching your social media following grow. You're watching like reactions come in, reviews, and it's kind of coming at you from all sides. It was always just kind of like you're pinching yourself because you're like, okay, I'm like on a show that's in 190 countries that's like showing for 200 million subscribers. And so there's, you know, a healthy amount of disbelief in there too, I think. And The Queen's Gambit was number one in the world, and then it was Tiny Pretty Things for several weeks, and then it was Bridgerton. And we were kind of getting metrics in our like cast chat about like projections about whether or not we were going to get picked up. And like, we all felt varying degrees of confidence. You know, I think everyone held out hope that we were going to get picked up. I was pretty confident that we were going to get picked up. I felt like, you know, we had reached the top of a ton of top 10 charts and we were doing very good, like globally. And so Netflix notified us like 30 days pretty much to the T after we released that we weren't going to be renewed.
Which must have come as like a shock.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we, you know, like the showrunner emailed the cast and the like first sentence is just like, this is the email I never thought I'd have to write. I think really we as a cast got so close. We knew we were working on something special. Like there really just was this sense of like, we're creating a thing of beauty. And everybody as a collective, I think the whole show, crew, creatives, cast, like we all wanted to make this thing the best it could be. And like, we felt like season one was like our first stab at it. So we were like, okay, we can, like, we did a really good job, but we can do better. And so we were all hungry to like go back and use what we had learned, like filming 10 episodes of a very complicated show.
Yeah, because it's not just the acting and the scene work, but then you have to do all the choreography working together. So
16 hour days, 6 days a week, because we were rehearsing on the weekends and in the mornings and in ballet class. Like the scheduling was just, I could not imagine being an AD on that show would have been like.
Yeah, because a normal episode is what, you know, 6 to 7 days, but you have to add in the extra time of learning the dances, partnering, and all the things you have to do. So did they still try to scrunch that into 6 or 7 days? Or did they give you time to do that?
Yeah, we filmed in blocks. So each block was 2 episodes. So we had 5 blocks. We had 5 directors and a new director for each block. And it was 2.5 weeks per block. So it leveled out to like 5 months, I think. And we had kind of like a 2-week boot camp where we were all like getting to know one another as the ensemble and taking class and, you know, hoping we were in shape to do 5 months of like the longest marathon of our lives. It was incredibly demanding. I mean, holy smokes. We worked with 7 world-class choreographers and we were constantly bouncing around Toronto between, you know, the National Ballet of Canada and our sets and trying to remember scenes, trying to remember choreography and then your character work and like director sessions and like working with coaches, and several of us had like accent coaches and religious consultants and like intimacy coordinating sessions. And like, there's just so many layers. And it was just kind of like, go, 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 go.
And all this was really new to you. Like to combine the dancing, and you've done a little bit of acting, but to do it at this level.
And that's, I think, what was so amazing about it was it really felt like the major leagues. Like it was, you know, I did the male lead for Center Stage 3. Find it on Lifetime or don't.
Right.
And so that was a very much like dance acty, like camp moment. And this was like that, but so much better. Like it was really the major leagues. It was the NFL of like dancing and acting and doing it all together. Like I was working with these choreographers who I'd been dreaming of working with, and I was getting to do scene work for a show, and I was getting to develop this character, and I really fell in love with the character that I was portraying and went really, really deep and into that experience. And so it was new and it was super high pressure, and there's just something about it. Like the pressure is just addicting. Like I can't get enough.
Now, there are those actors who almost like to not prepare and then like last minute will then kind of cram the lines and kind of have that kinetic energy of, is it that kind of feel where it's almost like you want to be on the edge of, I don't know what's going to happen, but let's just go for it.
There were definitely days on, because there was just so much material. I mean, you're just, they're giving you so much to work on that it's just like, you're just going to do the best you can with what you have, you know, and you're new, like, and you're like not a classically trained actor. Like, so, you know, you have this skill set, you're coming in, that you're, like, I'm very confident, I'm a world-class dancer, and I'm going in with that. And then it's like, but I feel like a total freshman as an actor. Yes, I know I have natural ability, but like the technique is like what gives us longevity and is what gives us, you know, the stuff we can rely on our off days, those tools to still produce a wonderful performance when, you know, when the fire alarm is going off in the building at 3 a.m. and you didn't get any sleep the night before, which happens so many times. So it was just kind of doing the best you could with what you had. There was so many days where it was like, I'm in the makeup chair getting my tattoos covered, cramming the sides for what we were going to work on that day. And, you know, credit to our directors, like we had such wonderful creatives on the show and they really believed in us and they put a lot of faith in us as new people, you know, like it's a pretty big investment to just go straight to series regulars for a 10 episode season. And, you know, I think they turned out a really amazing product for where we were at and the material that we had.
It wasn't just the acting that was new to you, but then, you know, you'd waited a year. It finally comes out a year later. And now you're dealing with the fame, the questions, the interviews, the, you know, fans coming up to you, I'm sure, and autographs or this or that, being recognized. That's a whole other part of it that must have been new to you as well.
Yeah. You know, it was kind of interesting because it was like I did feel like I got gypped a little bit by the pandemic because, you know, you think it's like a global Netflix premiere. There's going to be a red carpet and there's going to be, but we're in a pandemic. And so like, there was no such thing. Like I literally was in my living room for like the premiere of my global like Netflix debut.
In your sweats watching
fully
your,
in my yes. sweats, like go me. So there was kind of like, it was kind of the arrow moment when it premiered. And then like, you think that like, everybody's going to recognize me, but then you're like walking around with a mask on. So it's like, nobody recognized me. You know, the first person who recognized me was this like sweet old lady. And it was like summer at, you know, after we had been canceled. And it was this like flower event in the meatpacking district, and this old woman was like, she just saw me and pointed and was like, tiny pretty things. And I was like, yeah,
yes ma'am.
And she goes, my first celebrity sighting. And I was like, I think you need to raise your standards.
You made her day.
I was, and like, I felt so good. I was like, oh my gosh, like I was recognized. So like, it's happened with a lot more frequency now that we're kind of like back in normal life. And it is so interesting because you get like, it's just this amazing experience, like getting to share this thing that you've worked so hard on with the world. And I really believed like in my character's story and I saw the value in it. And then to have that kind of stripped from you, you're still, and then to have to keep it secret from the world for so
was
long.
Was that a cast decision or
it
did
was
Netflix?
A cast decision.
Okay. Did Netflix tell you to not?
So Netflix was essentially like, do what you want. Like, we're not announcing it. So Netflix does not announce their cancellations. They don't want to like, they don't want to be like, hey, yell at us.
well, especially 30 days after it premiered.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's the reason like the cast decided we really came together and discussed it. I was very much in the camp of wanting to share with the world that it was canceled. You know, I wanted to commiserate with the rest of the fan base and like have kind of a group catharsis of like, you know, woe is us. It's so beautiful what we did, and it's so sad that it's not coming back. And like, share that so we can all kind of experience it at once instead of like over and over again and in small doses and like spread out over such a long time of like, you know, people finding out that it's getting canceled like in waves. And we as a cast decided that it would be best not to share the cancellation because we wanted people to come to the show without that knowledge. Like, we wanted people to still come to episode one and be invested in the story with all their heart and not have to like be like, oh, it's only one season, like might as well just skip it. Like, we still wanted people to watch it. We still wanted to give it its due, to give it its time and the respect. Like, it was only out for 30 days, you know? And in that 30 days, like, over 11 million people streamed the entire 10 episodes, you know? But, like, I know for a fact, like, it's tens and tens of millions of people who have streamed the entire series. And I think we would have robbed a lot of them of our show had we announced the cancellation sooner. I do think I was the first person to break the news, though. I think it was 8 months or something, 7 months, like after we found out, where I was just like, okay, I just want people to know, because like it eventually got to the point where people were constantly commenting, messaging like season two, season two, season two, season two, season two. And I was just silent. Like, it was just like never answering the question. You know, nobody in the cast was answering that question. Like, there's just like comments and comments and comments. And it was just like, I want to engage. Like, I don't want to shut people off. I wanted to be honest. And so I know for me, I was ready to like have that moment of like, we can commiserate together. Like, the fans can know that like season two won't be coming back. And like, we also didn't want to like capitalize on the anger. Like, we weren't, I definitely think a lot of us were like, well, maybe there will be like a petition and like we can get it to come back. And if the, like, if we get people pissed enough, but like, we never wanted to make people pissed. Like, we wanted people to experience a thing of beauty.
To love the show.
We wanted them to love the show and to love the drama. And so I think, you know, I definitely value the decision that we made and the course that we took in kind of handling that. And I think that a lot of people were able to see the show because we held on to that information strategically for a little while. But definitely interesting kind of navigating the like social media following blowing up, and I don't think I would call it fame. Sometimes it feels like fame. It's so interesting. Like, I feel like when you asked me to do the podcast, I was like, but I am gonna make it. Like, I still in my mind, like, I was like, I was coming up against it, but like, it's so interesting because thinking that I am gonna make it infers in my mind that I have not yet made it, and I have filmed a global Netflix show which is making it, you know, like
that's a version of making
and
it.
So
yes,
it's this same kind of fluid thing where your metric of success is constantly changing, you know. Like, I've done, like, this was like the most visible job of my career and arguably one of the most gratifying. And I certainly, in those 6 months of working on this show, felt like I had made it. And like, I suppose my metric for success in waiting for the show's renewal was going to be the show's renewal. You know, I was like, okay, I've made it. Like, I could do this show for 4 or 5 seasons and like walk away with padded pockets. And now I'm in this space where like, okay, I'm not going to be Orin Lennox for the next 8 years. I have to find out who I am capable of being. And so I have to redefine what making it is. And it's so interesting because like this idea of making it, there's never any point where your problems disappear, where the struggle disappears, where the challenges go away. Maybe that happens for 10 people out of 7.5 billion. And maybe this is the dancer in me, but there's just a part of me that like loves the struggle so much. Like, I'm just kind of like enamored by by the difficulty of it, and it makes it that much sweeter when you do achieve your goals and your dreams. Like, if you didn't have to kind of struggle for it, then are you really gonna recognize when you have made it? And that's something that's so great, is like, making it is something you can do many times.
Exactly. It's an ongoing process of continuously making it, starting over, making it again.
Yeah. And like, I just feel like I've started from scratch. Like, it's like, okay, I like achieved a very high level of success as a dancer and as an actor, but then like
30
start
days
over.
Later.
But then just like start over. Yeah. Like, yeah, pretend like it didn't happen, you know, and like go and just go to class. Like, that's, and who knows if it's the right choice. I think nothing is binary, you know, right and wrong is just such a myth. We live in a world where everything is nuanced and complicated, and so I just don't think there's a right and a wrong.
When it comes to auditions, we are often hindered by that idea Barton speaks of, making right or wrong choices. Whether we're acting, singing, or dancing, we sometimes feel like every move has to be perfect or we've failed the audition. When in reality, all we have to do is make strong choices that come from us, that unique special sauce that only we can bring into the audition room. For the next couple of weeks, I'll be presenting my annual Audition Stories episode, as well as an interview with a prominent New York casting director. You'll hear firsthand the unique challenges that auditions can bring, as well as the opportunities they provide. You'll walk away with some audition tips and hopefully some motivation and inspiration for your next audition. All that starts next week here on Why I'll Never Make It. But now let's get back to my conversation with Barton as he shares how he expanded his artistic endeavors during the pandemic, at a time when most of us were just trying to figure out how to still be an artist.
Well, that leads us into our third story. You obviously experienced what all of us artists went through in 2020, just a complete dismantling of our livelihoods, of our careers, and it put everything in a standstill, myself included. I mean, just being kind of stuck in our careers, like, well, there's nothing to do now. So what prompted you to want to go from dance to acting during a time where there was no work to be had?
Good question. Yeah, I mean, I had this amazing experience right before the pandemic where I shot a series regular for a Netflix show. And I was dancing in it and I was acting in it. And I just fell in love with working on a character and, you know, the pressure of being on set and like having so many people relying on like you being able to hit the mark and say your lines and have the emotionality. And then I was like, okay, I have to learn how to act. Like, after the show wrapped. So then I was like, I was still dancing. I was doing the principal role in La Traviata at the Metropolitan Opera, and then the world shut down and I was like, well, I'm not really dancing, so I'm gonna throw myself into acting class. And obviously Zoom is not an ideal location to be in acting class, but
because had you taken acting classes before?
Not really. I think I had taken one like short on camera class.
So this was really going to be your first time to go into the deep end of acting.
Yeah. And like theater, you know, I had done like a little bit of on camera stuff, but I really hadn't like done a ton of like script analysis and plays. And I hadn't done a lot of monologue work and sensory work or anything like that. And so I just kind of, I don't know. We all kind of, I think, faced this reevaluation of like what's important. You know, we're all asking these questions of like, who am I? What do I want to be? Where do I want to go? How can I utilize this time? And I don't always know why I do the things that I do, but I do have like strong compulsions. And that's just what this was I just felt like I knew that I needed to be in class and to train as an actor. And so that's kind of what I did for the last 2 years, was just take a bunch of intensives and classes. And, you know, it's been difficult and wild, but also amazing.
So with your background rooted in dance, you know, then making this transition to acting and using your body differently, was that a difficult transition for you to go from this movement-based expression to more spoken dialogue and character work?
Yes, definitely. It was like, it was difficult, but it also felt natural. Like this, it wasn't like a sudden shift where it was like, oh, I'm just an actor now. Like, it was kind of this underlying theme in my career. I had always been like a very theatrical, sensitive, emotional performer as a dancer. You know, my first job out of college was playing Romeo in a rock ballet of Romeo and Juliet. So that's such a theatrical performance and obviously a timeless classic. And so I was always interested in playing roles and in portraying characters, but using your voice is something that dancers, you know, you just don't train it. And like all artists, I think, have training as a theme. And so dance brings this discipline of like, you take ballet class every morning before you rehearse. Like there is just this, like, to be a dancer, you have to train consistently. Like you have to be in class. And so moving into acting, I just brought that. Like I got good at dancing by being in class consistently, even as a professional. And so after I had done like the biggest job of my career on this Netflix show, I was like, okay, time to go to class and approach acting kind of as a dancer. But I still deal with kind of stripping myself of my like posture and like the muscle memory that like 2 decades of dancing puts on you. Like it is not conducive to playing a lot of characters. Like it's helpful for some, but like it's kind of the antithesis of what like playing a lot of normal people is. And I think the theatricality in movement, it can be over embellished when you're transferring it onto camera or into theater. Like I'm naturally a very big mover. I'm very expressive. And so moving into theater and using my voice, like it's this other element that I'm like, okay, I can downplay the physical and make a little bit more noise. And that balances, like that's still equal energy output. And it's been like a very interesting navigation process.
Yeah, I bet, because now you're using your body differently and you have to expend that energy in different ways.
Yeah, there's definitely more classical movements or contemporary movements or like jazz elements like that. Like there's genres of music, there's definitely genres of dancing, there's genres
of modern and ballet versus hip hop versus whatever.
Flavors, if you will.
Yes, the multiple flavors. And do you consider yourself able to transition to those different flavors of dance?
As a dancer, I consider myself very versatile, which I've been trying to get better at this in my castings to kind of like figure out if it's a dance casting, I want to pinpoint what style they're looking for and then say that's my style. Because if you go into a casting, especially if it's like a modeling thing and they're like asking for a self-tape and they're like, perform for us.
Show your personality.
Do always. Something impressive.
Yes.
And then they're like, okay, what's your style? I've in the past been like, oh, I can do whatever you want. Like I can do hip hop or ballet or heaven's rid, throw on some tap shoes. But a lot of times casting wants you, like, they don't know what they want. So it's like if you go in and you're like, oh, I'm classical ballet, that makes it a lot more digestible and easier for them to be like, oh, okay, I can envision that now.
Doesn't your resume as a dancer give them a sense of what you do? Or is a dancer resume a little different in that respect?
I would assume so. But like, it depends on what you're getting cast for. Not a lot of people have knowledge of like the concert dance world. So if you're auditioning for concert dance work, then they'll be familiar with some stuff on the resume. But like musical theater stuff, like they're not going to know everything that's on my resume. Like modeling stuff, they're not going to know. They're going to know even less about the dance world that's on my resume. And so like it's just kind of a roll of the dice. It's a crapshoot.
Now, this is a two-part question. You alluded to this earlier, but first, In what ways did dancing help you as an actor?
You know, I think dance, it's always been like my first love as a means of expression, of kind of like how to get my yah-yahs out. And acting has just felt like the natural progression. But I think really it's the discipline of dance that transfers into theater. Like if I approach my acting with the same dedication and drive and studiousness that it took me to achieve what I did as a dancer, then I imagine, you know, after a great amount of patience, that I assume I'll achieve similar heights as an actor.
So then the second part of that is, what habits or instincts as a dancer did you have to ignore, change in order to become a better actor?
Yeah, I mean, my instinct is usually to go pretty big. I think that's just because, especially in classical ballet, like there's all these kind of dance acting steps that are used to communicate to the audience what's happening in the story. You know, they're doing kind of like, they're rolling their hands around each other to say, we're about to dance for you. Or like they're pointing to their left ring finger to say that we're getting engaged. Like there's just these like over the top gestures that are used to communicate the plot, what normally would be the words. And so it's kind of moving against that to be more human and more natural in the ways that I communicate, because, you know, I've had years and years of communicating really, really big. And then when you're working in camera and a little, the stage work and the musical theater stuff is like a great middle ground, but like camera work can be so minute, you know, it can literally just be like hold still and like twitch your cheek on the right beat, you know, like
it's that stillness on camera that is so important. And for myself in musical theater, I know that I'm often told to, okay, bring it down when I'm on camera. Okay, less, do less, because I'm used to 2,000 seats out there. I got to fill it. So it sounds like as a dancer, there is also that stillness that you have to learn so that it doesn't become too big on camera.
Yeah. And really my passion for acting was doing improv and sketch comedy. And that's a pretty big medium in terms of like the acting and theater world. Like improv and sketch comedy is very physical stuff usually, and so like it was a great kind of addition to my dancing. But I'd say even my kind of intro to acting was in like a larger scale form of expression, whereas like it's definitely just so much more focused when you're on camera.
I took improv classes as well, and you're right. It is a way to go big or go home. You know, you commit to it, yes, and whatever is brought to you, you give it back tenfold. You know, there is that. And I love that freedom, and I think that there's like a kernel of that that we have to then use as on-camera actors.
Yeah, you know, I think it should all be there. The desire to be big, to make a big choice, like that should live inside of the choice you make. It's just like, you know, if it's the same amount of matter, it's just more dense. It's like you don't want to do something small just because you're on camera, but have it be less than.
I think you hit upon a good word, density.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, it's a simple, it's a small movement, but it's dense. There's thickness to it,
yeah,
because you can feel the emotion, whatever you're trying to portray in it.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, that comes with time of like working on a part, you know. That's true for dance as much as it is theater, is like rehearsing something and repeating it and being coached in something is what helps you discover the emotionality, the layers, the personality that comes to life in your choices and in your performances. And that's kind of like, it's really great when you can find, for camera work, when you can find that density where like you're making a small but very focused, very alive choice. Those are always really exciting moments.
And one of the things that can inhibit those kind of choices is something I think all of us as artists, we try to avoid, and that is tension. As a singer myself, tension in the throat and the voice can impact the sound that comes out as I sing. As an actor, it can inhibit our movements so that we seem stilted or, you know, like a brick wall on stage. As a dancer, how does tension negatively impact your movement?
Good question. I think that tension in dance, it distracts from the efficiency, you know, like I had a ballet master who kind of described ballet as every muscle performing to the best of its ability without affecting its neighbor. And I think tension is when something affects the neighbor. If my goal is to get my leg to a certain height, like you're engaging a certain set of muscle groups, but then you want to maintain this kind of like poise and grace in the upper body to, you know, the audience is looking at your face. Like they want to see you having fun, even though you're screaming inside. I think that if you're tense, it shows. You know, you gotta have confidence. Tension maybe is a lack of sureness of the choice, of the material, of what you're performing. But I think that there's no such thing as being completely relaxed, you know? Like, it's important to find as a relaxed state as possible, but no one wants to see you asleep on stage.
Like, of course.
Tension can be very valuable because it's information in our body. Tension can tell us what's happening. It can tell us how we're reacting to something. It can tell us our habits. I feel like tension is that muscle memory of our kind of responses to what's happening either in the material or in your life. And so if you're aware of it, you can channel it. You can either release it or use the tension to inform a delivery, or you can like exercise it like an exorcism and like and put it into the work, you know? Like if you're feeling tense emotionally, physically, it's what's so rewarding about living in an expressive medium. You can alleviate the tension through performance.
Whenever you were doing these acting classes and training, and it's like, okay, I'm now going to exercise this part, you know, leave the dance aside for a bit, focus on acting. What was going to be the measure of success or progress with that? Since you knew what dancing was, but acting was still new, so what did progress mean? What was that going to look like to you?
That's a good question, and I'm definitely still figuring that out for myself, because I'm still so much in the throes of, I feel like, becoming an actor. And that's probably an endless journey. But I had a career as a dancer, which is, I'm going to tell you a secret, it's not the most lucrative career financially. And I did this Netflix show, and I made some real money for the first time. And so, you know, first instinct is like, money is going to be the measure of success, obviously. And, you know, now that I'm 3 years and not that many jobs into it, I'm kind of like, okay, well, what is the measure of success? And that's a great question to constantly be asking yourself, because I don't feel like it's a fixed answer. I feel like it's a fluid answer, and I feel like it should change as your priorities will in life. But, you know, I did a month-long method intensive recently, and I was really proud of how I took that class. It was 4 days a week, 10 to 1 in the mornings and 7 to 10 in the evenings. You were supposed to come to one of those slots a day minimum. You could double up when you wanted to. And like, I didn't miss a single day. I filled an entire notebook. I put up 3 scenes. Like, I really just came in with a fire into this class. And I learned so much, and I still have so much room to grow. But man, like that, I was technically in the red, you know, like I spent money to take the class. But in terms of the metric for success, like I was so, so proud with how I took the class. And I just proved to myself that like I'm an actor. And I think the metric of success is believing that to be true, to like know what you're capable of and to bring that into the room and to bring that into your tapes. So I think that's, for me as like someone who, I feel like I'm starting out, you know, which is not the case. But I think the metrics of success is at this stage, feeling more confident in the tapes that I'm making, feeling more confident in the classes that I'm taking. And then eventually my metric for success can be, you know, my IMDb page or my finances or the empire that I will build. But right now, it's a feeling.
I think you're so right that it does change throughout our career. It can even change depending on the project, because I've done those that were artistically fulfilling without much pay, and I've certainly done those that paid really well, and I was bored stupid the whole time. So different projects will have their own measure of success or what it means. It's like, why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm. And I try and remind myself at the end of every day, like, you know, pursuing an art as a career is wild, but when you get to do it, it's a pretty amazing thing and something to be super, super grateful for.
Thank you so much for joining Barton and me today, and remember the conversation continues with the final five questions on the WinMe blog. You'll find a link to that in the show notes or by going to whyillnevermakeit.com. This week's listener feedback comes from RJ on YouTube, who reacted to my interview with Stephen Warner from The Little Prince. He writes, "This interview is really great. Such great insight and so many good stories. I love how you let Mr. Warner just tell stories and speak, and then your interactions are so natural. This is the kind of stuff that used to be on DVDs and Blu-rays, and I wish still was. It's why I loved getting physical media and still do. It feeds the film nerd in me. Thank you for doing this. I hope if they ever release it on Blu-ray, they get with you and include this. I feel it's essential and a wonderful addition that would be appreciated by film fans. Great job." Well, thank you so much, RJ. I agree with you that in this digital age of streaming, one of the things often missing are those behind-the-scenes look at actors and the filming process, not to mention all those deleted scenes and bloopers. So, Paramount, if you're listening, I'm available for that Blu-ray release when you are, and RJ will definitely be first in line to buy it. Well, I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, in charge of writing, editing, and producing this podcast. Background music is by John Bartman and Blue Dot Sessions. Why I'll Never Make It is a WinMe Media production and is part of the Helium Radio Network and a member of the Broadway Makers Alliance. Join me next time for a collection of audition stories as we talk more about Why I'll Never Make It.